And for those who don't know, this is one of the best of talks from the linux.conf.au that we just had, the Linux conference run by Linux Australia.
Can you hear me okay?
It's maybe a little harder.
Can you hear me all right? Anything? Louder? Okay. Just a second while I get my slides up.
If you are sitting on the edges, you might want to draw into the middle a little bit to let people who are coming in late find a seat.
There we go. Hi, I'm Doug Chapman. As he mentioned, I work for Hewlett Packard in the United States. And a little bit about myself here. Get the mic working better. A little bit about myself. Primarily, I work on really large systems for Hewlett Packard. We have the large I-64 systems. My primary job is I can't seem to get this to... Let me hook it a little closer. Is that better? Or maybe I should just use the handheld mic. Do we have a handheld mic I could use? That might work better. This should work better. Okay, I'll start over. I'm Doug Chapman. I'm from New Hampshire in the United States, working for Hewlett Packard. My primary day-to-day job is I work on our large I-64 Linux servers, primarily making sure they work well with Red Hat and Fedora. What I'm talking about today, however, is a project that I did on my own time, mostly as a way to learn some more Linux kernel development. And it's really on the far extreme opposite end of the large I-64 systems. It's a small autonomous robot that I had built. What it is, it's to give you a sense of scale, the rules of the competition that I entered say that it needs to fit within a 30-centimeter cube, and the robot comes pretty close to that. I tried to make it smaller, but fitting everything in was a little difficult. It's a two-wheeled robot. It has, you can see one wheel on this side, and then there's a caster wheel on the back. Simply steers by varying the speed of the motors. It's completely autonomous, so it has sensors to sense the world. We have some infrared distance sensors and some sonar sensors so they can sense its environment. And also there's some sensors that can pick up candle heat, and you'll see what that's about when I talk about the competition. This is actually, for those of you who saw my talk the other day, I realized I didn't include this slide before. I had some people ask, so why the name Rockhopper? And simply, since it runs Linux, and of course Tux the penguin being the Linux mascot, I wanted to give it a penguin name, and Rockhopper is it's a breed of penguin, and mostly I chose it because the alliteration sounds good, Rockhopper robot. Okay, so the competition that I entered this in, it's a competition held every year at Trinity College in the United States. It's in Hartford, Connecticut in the United States. For those of you not familiar, that's in the up in the northeast corner of the country. Now, we have this thing in the United States called BattleBots, where we have fighting robots that are remote controlled. That you probably have seen similar things like that. That's not what this is about. I find that stuff very interesting as well. It's always neat seeing sparks and destruction always gets a good crowd response. But this is a completely autonomous robot. It doesn't have any remote control. It has its own programming where it can sense the environment and make its own decisions. The purpose of the competition is to try to create something that could be a firefighting robot. There's a maze that's supposed to look somewhat like the floor plan of a house. The robot needs to be able to navigate through that maze and find a candle and extinguish it. I entered the expert division of the competition. There's multiple divisions. They have the great thing about it is they have divisions that are simplified so kids can enter with their Lego Mindstorms robots, and then multiple divisions all the way up to the expert division. And the extra challenges in the expert division are you don't know the layout of the maze ahead of time, so you can't program a predetermined route for it to follow, since you don't know what that maze is going to look like. And you'll have two candles that you need to extinguish, and they have a simulated baby, which is just a small light bulb that they painted black so that it looks like body heat. So here's an example of what the maze might look like. Like I said, you don't know what it's going to look like until the day of the competition. And you'll notice there's things like if you're always following the right wall, you'll end up going in a circle. So you do need some level of navigation in order to be able to see the whole maze. What's not shown on here is along one wall, there'll be an opening the width of one of the hallways, and there'll be a ramp that goes up to a simulated second story. And this is a little hard to see, but you can see a couple of the lines are darker. They laid out the grid and the walls on about the same lines, so it's a little difficult to see. But you can see there's two rooms in the upper story. So typically what will happen is there'll be one candle downstairs, one candle upstairs, and the robot needs to be able to find both of those and extinguish them. Okay, so now that we know a little bit about the competition, we can start actually building a robot. And it's a physical thing. It needs some kind of a body. There's no rule saying that you can't use like a prefabricated commercial robot base, and some people do that. I enjoy building things, so I wasn't completely happy with the design of any of the commercial ones, so I built my own base. And in the open source tradition, I wanted to use open source software for the designing. So I used a drawing program. It's a very simple drawing program. It's been all around on Unix and Linux for many years, called Xfig. That's good for drawing geometric shapes. So I laid out the designs for the different panels that would later be cut out of plastic. And with this, I was able to lay out very accurate markings for holes, and so that I could cut the sheets out. So I simply would print these out, stick it to a sheet of plastic, and I could cut those sheets out. So we have the upper left is one of the side panels. I was able to accurately mark all the holes for mounting the motors. Down here we have the top and bottom panel and all the holes for bolting those together. And on the upper right is the hub for the wheel that I made, which is on the center of that was also out of, this is all out of PVC, sheets of PVC plastic. And here, it might be a little hard to see on this projector, but these are all the pieces after I had cut them out. And the wheels to the right, you'll see that I made rubber tires out of those using it's a two-part silicone that you mix together with a hardener, and I made a mold to cast a tire. So then it's just a matter of bolting these parts together and mounting electronics. Okay, so now that we have some sort of a physical body for the robot, we need some electronics so that we can, control the robot and sense the world. The main control of the robot is done by an ARM processor running Linux, which I'll talk about a little bit later. But I needed more ways to, or I needed more sensor inputs, and also I wanted to isolate that a little bit in case I did short anything out. The ARM board's fairly expensive. These are fairly cheap. So I made, I designed some boards using a small 8-bit microcontroller, known as the ABR 18 Mega 32. They make multiple versions of this ABR microcontroller. They're for amateurs like me. I'm not a hardware guy. I'm really just a software guy who knows enough to kind of guess at how to design hardware. So these are very simple design. It doesn't take much hardware knowledge to design a board around one of these. And what each one of these gives me is more analog to digital ports that lets me connect more sensors back to the robot, and then they can talk to, these boards can talk to the main controller of the robot over a what's called an I2C communication. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. The great thing about these AVR boards is they're really very open source friendly. You can use GCC to compile code for them, and you can there's open source tools to actually download the program into the AVR microcontroller. So I was able to do all the software development for these under Linux, and the board design I was able to do under Linux using a tool called Eagle, which isn't open source but does run under Linux and is free for non-commercial use. I plan on since I did this about a year ago, and since then I've learned about some open source tools that I can use to hopefully design the next one. Just to give you an idea for the guys who love hardware in here, here's the schematic of the board that I made, and it actually looks more complex than it is. Most of what you see here are simple connectors so that I can actually plug my sensors in and plug my communication my communication bus in. And just this, it really doesn't take much to get one of these running. All you really need is, hopefully you can see the mouse here, but here's a resistor that pulls the reset pin high, a couple of capacitors to filter out some noise, and you put power to it, and then right here I've got an LED that I can blink lights on. So, you know, bare minimum, if you want to just, you know, download a program, see if it's working, that's really all you need. So they're really quite simple. To the right is the actual layout of the board with all the parts placed. And then I was able to send that out to a company to have the actual boards fabricated, and then solder the components on myself. And here you can see the actual boards. In the upper right, there's a stack. There's actually three of them stacked on top of each other. Those are the boards I'm using to interface with my sensors. And there's a communication bus. It's a little hard to see, but on the upper right, there's a rainbow-colored ribbon connector that's the communication bus. And then there's three ribbon connectors going off to the front of the robot that's used to interface with the sensors that are picking up the candle heat. And here's a few of the sensors that I used. On the top there is it's a distance sensor. It shines out an infrared light and can detect, you know, how far away walls are, so it can, you know, do things like avoid walls. Just below that is a sonar sensor. It does similar thing, just with a ping for time of flight, which works fairly well. Sonars are a little funny to use, I've found. Because they reflect off things you wouldn't expect them to reflect off of. And on the bottom there is it's a sensor that you would find in like a motion detector light, like you would use over a driveway, turns the light on when someone goes by. I use that sensor to find the simulated baby, the 15-watt light bulb that they use to simulate the baby. And what you're supposed to do when you find the baby is drop a beeper in that room, so that in theory, real firefighter could listen for the beeper and go find the baby. I never actually got that part working too well, unfortunately. Okay, so now the part that's most pertinent to this conference is, the part that actually runs Linux. This is it's an ARM processor. It's the same processor that's typically used in things like iPacs. A lot of cell phones use that processor now, so it's really become very popular. It runs Linux well, and the board that I use that is a what's called a PC-104 form factor, which, if you remember the old ISA buses from older PCs, it's essentially based on the same bus. It's just a different form factor so that the expansion boards can stack on top of each other. And in this picture, it's a little hard to see in these pictures, but on the top there is a digital I/O board that allows me to communicate with external devices. And here, you can see it's a little crowded inside there with all the electronics, but there's the ARM board down in this corner. Several wires connecting things, and believe it or not, this is much cleaner than some of my older designs. As time goes by, I actually get better at keeping my wires under control, so you can imagine what the old ones looked like. And various other hardware needed to make it work, things like a voltage regulator to give it power, a USB wireless Ethernet, which is one of the things that makes it really easy to use, since I don't need to connect any cables to be able to communicate with it. I can do that all over wireless Ethernet, and things like a USB flash drive that I use to store my programs on it. And I mentioned the communications. I also, on the side of the robot, there's a wired Ethernet port on there, and also a 9-pin serial port that I can use for the console. This is really just for when I run into problems where it doesn't boot. I can connect into these and hopefully figure out what the problems are. So some of the challenges in getting Linux to run on this board, the company that makes this actually is pretty Linux friendly, and they ship the board with a 2.4 kernel. And I could have made that work for me, but the whole goal behind this is I wanted to learn how to do some more kernel development, and I wanted to do that on the latest kernel, of course. So there's some community support on mailing lists for other people working on 2.6 kernels on these. So between the mailing list and a little bit of hacking around, I was able to finally get the 2.6 kernel. The biggest problem was the physical memory is it's not laid out contiguously. There's chunks of 8 meg with huge gaps between them. So that was an interesting thing for me as more of a user space programmer to really understand, you know, down at the low level how it really finds its memory when it's not all contiguous, since I had to deal with physical addresses. But with a little bit of hacking and some support from other people on the mailing list, I finally got the 2.620 kernel running on this. That was about a year ago, that was the latest kernel that was out at the time. The biggest thing I wanted to learn was, as part of this project, was how to write device drivers. I had seen, you know, in theory I knew how they worked, and I'd looked at device driver code, but I'd never written one from scratch. So I wrote a device driver that uses, that communicates with the digital I/O board on the ARM. And what that gives me is it gives me 24 pins where I can connect to the world. I can configure them either as an input where it can sense if the voltage coming in on that is either 0 volts or 5 volts, or I can configure it as an output and drive a pin at 0 volts or 5 volts. So I can do things like control a motor. So, I can't run the motor at 5 volts, but with that 5 volt signal, I can talk to another bit of hardware that can actually send voltage to the motors. I also needed to be able to vary the speed of the motors, and the way you do that is with something called pulse width modulation, or PWM. And to get half speed to the motors, you simply pulse that pin at about 50% duty cycle to slow down the speed of the motor, and that's what allows me to give some level of control. So I did some work on the timer interrupt so that it could toggle that pin high or low, control my speed, control the direction, and was able to write a device driver that worked well for all that. Now, the way I communicate with those, earlier I was talking about the AVR boards that I designed that allows me to talk to my flame sensors and some of the other sensors, is a protocol called I2C, which is a nice simple protocol. It only requires two lines. You don't need any real synchronization between the master and the client. Like if it was an RS-232 serial port, both the master and the client need to agree on how fast they're talking and they can get out of sync, especially on something like a very simple 8-bit microcontroller that doesn't have an accurate clock. Well, with this two-wire interface, it uses one wire for the data, another wire for the clock, so you don't have those issues, and it's a very robust protocol. What I discovered, though, is some of the sonar devices that I bought also speak I2C. And I don't have much control. Those are actually pre-made devices. I don't have control over exactly how they work. And unfortunately, I found out that they pull that clock line low when they're waiting for a ping. So what had happened is the device driver I was using on the Linux side would get confused every time that client would pull that pin low, and then the device driver would sit there just polling, waiting for that pin to come high. So as I added more code and tried reading sensors more quickly, it would run into situations where I would actually hang that device driver. So, excellent chance for me to do a little bit more work on that. So a little more device driver work. So I had to rewrite that code. And as I mentioned, I know enough kernel stuff to fix simple bugs, which is what I do in my primary job. But doing things like this was definitely a learning experience for me. I needed to rewrite this device driver so that it could work as on an interrupt basis. The device driver is designed so that it can be configured using any two general purpose I/O pins on the board. So I was able to rewire how I had things hooked up so that the clock line was hooked to a line that has interrupt capability, and then rewrite the device driver so that instead of polling, waiting for that line to come high, it could wait on an interrupt. So that allowed it to go do other things and not be stuck just polling on that. In the end, it worked. It sometimes still hangs up, which I haven't quite understood, but I was able to get things working to the point where it's somewhat reliable, and actually I was able to make it functional enough. So a lot of people ask me, what distribution are you running now? They want to know, is it a Fedora robot or a Debian robot? And actually, with only 32 megabytes of flash space, it really doesn't have enough space for a full Linux distribution, but you really don't have a need for that either. All I really need is a simple environment where I can run programs. So my home role distribution involves the kernel, which I already talked about, a utility called BusyBox, which is used in embedded systems like this often, where it's one binary that has the capability of doing, pretty much every shell command, just with a few features removed that aren't commonly used. And it has things like ifconfig, so you can bring up your network, and other pretty much everything you need to have a functional system. The one thing that was missing is it didn't have the ability to run an SSH server. I wanted to be able to connect to the robot using SSH so that I can log in and do debugging on the robot itself. So I had to add a utility called DropBear, which is just a very small SSH server that I actually learned about from looking at the BusyBox website, since they know that they don't support SSH, so they tend to point people at this DropBear. So of course needed several shared libraries that were needed by my program, and a really handy utility called GDB server, which in order to do debugging with GDB, the GNU debugger, there's really not enough horsepower on the robot itself to be able to do GDB debugging directly on it. So you can run this thing called GDB server, which connects to the program and opens up a network port so that on my desktop system, I could connect GDB to that port and talk to the server and do debugging that way. So then all the smarts of GDB are running on a regular system that has enough capability to do it, and the program's actually running on the small embedded device. So programming the robot. In the past, most of my robots have been more typical embedded devices where you need to build your program, then you need to plug a cable into the robot, reset it into some kind of a download mode so you can copy the program into the robot, disconnect the cable, reset it, and then you're running your program, which doesn't sound like much, but when you're making a lot of changes and you have to go, especially it's a robot, it's running around on the floor, you got to go chase it and pick it up and then reprogram it. That actually gets a little time consuming. You run into situations like, you end up making like 3 or 4 changes each time you download a program, and then when it breaks, you don't know which one of those changes actually broke it. So the great thing about this is, since it's running Linux and has wireless Ethernet, I can actually log into the robot. I can, I can see debugging output that way. I can do things like run NFS, where when I was doing the early development on this, the robot was NFS mounting the directory on my desktop system, so that all I had to do was recompile on the desktop system and without even touching the robot, I could restart the program and test the new code. And that made debugging this at the higher level AI code go so much more smoothly than what I'd done in the past. Another slide I need to add in here, as I need to mention, that I did win the competition that I had entered. So it actually did work out very successfully. I was very happy with how it worked. But the big thing I want to point out is why I ran into it. And why I was able to win the competition. The biggest thing is a lot of people run into these problems here where it sounds simple. The robot goes down a hall. We walk down halls all the time. We don't run into walls. And it just seems like a simple task. But you need to look at it in the point of view of a robot that's got very minimal sensor inputs. I have a total of 5 of those infrared distance sensors and 2 sonar sensors and some bump sensors where if everything else fails and it bumps into a wall. That's a really minimal view of the world, and writing an algorithm that works with just those sensors and works reliably actually can be harder than you think. And then you run into situations where those sensors don't give you the values you expect, or something completely unexpected happens. The robot needs to deal with all those things. And a lot of the robots there had some great high-level code, and the problem is they spent so much time working on high-level AI, how they're going to navigate the maze, how they're going to build a map as they go so they know if they've been in one room, they know not to go back into that room, and they can efficiently search the maze, but then they'd run into problems where it would get hung up on the corner and it'd be stuck, because they didn't really spend the time on those low-level, simple actions. So basically, people just tend to overthink the task and spend time on the what they think are the difficult things and overlook the simple stuff. So of course, keep it simple. That's the goal to making something like this robust. Start early. Build something with 2 motors and some kind of control, just something that can, just spinning a motor can be difficult, getting all the electronics working reliably. Then you start adding incremental functionality where, the first bit of code I wrote was simply, if the bumper gets triggered, back up and turn away. Okay, that bit of code works, I'm not going to touch that. That's one of the behaviors it has. Now let's move on to if there's an obstacle in the way that it sees with its infrared distance sensors. Move away from that, and okay, get that working well. add a little more functionality, and just keep going through this incremental design, continuing to test the code that's already there. And as you build all these simple behaviors together, you end up with something that appears to be much more intelligent than all the simple little parts. And what this is all based on is something called, it's an AI principle called the subsumption architecture, which was designed by Professor Rodney Brooks at MIT, who's actually Australian originally, by the way. Yay, Aussies. It's based on some simple behaviors, like I said, and each one has a priority. So like in my case, the highest priority was that bumper. No matter what happens, that behavior that's looking at the bumper has highest priority. If it gets hit, it's going to turn away from something. And you build up these behaviors on top of each other, and you make it look like it's much more complex. So here's actually an abbreviated list of the behaviors. Each one runs as an individual thread, and each one's a simple event loop. It looks at the sensor inputs and decides, what do I need to do, and do I want to be active or not? And just a simple loop like that. So the highest priority is my bumper avoid behavior, as I already talked about. The next one is, which I didn't mention, underneath the robot I have some sensors that can measure the wheel speed. If the wheels are turning slower than I expected, then that probably means that I'm stuck against something, but the bumper didn't trigger. So it does essentially the same thing. If the wheels aren't turning, back up and try to get unstuck. Just above that is my extinguish behavior, which is simply if a candle suddenly appears, turn on the fan. And that's really all that bit of code. It's a little more complicated than that, but that's essentially all that bit of code does. It's not tied in with any of the navigation code. It's not tied in with the bumper code. It's one simple bit of code that can be tested separately that simply puts a candle out. And then avoiding things with, the IR avoids things using the infrared distance sensors. The flame seek tries to seek out a candle. If it sees a candle to the left, turn to the left. Yeah. And then the sonar avoid, where it tries to avoid things using the sonar sensors and so on, all the way up to the hallway is, if all goes well, go straight is really about all that code does, and tries to stay closer to the center of the hallway. So now what I'd actually like to do is hopefully we can make this work. It worked the other day when I did this talk, and I only gave it a 50-50 shot of working then, so by logic that means it probably won't work now. But I wasn't able to pack the robot and bring it here. It's fairly fragile, and getting it through customs and all that. The last time I even shipped it, I brought it with me on an airplane flight. Domestically in the United States, I ended up rebuilding it. So this is a live shot in my workshop in New Hampshire in the United States with the webcam. And you can see I have a simple maze set up, and we have there's a candle in here that'll have some light in a little bit. In this window, you can see I'm actually logged into the robot itself. I'll have to put the microphone down for just a second. You can see, doing unames is the simple way to prove, yes, it really is Linux. It's running 2620-dirty, of course, because it's one that I had made some changes to. It's a full shell environment, and I should be able to run the program and make the robot navigate the maze. And we'll see if this works. There's about a 5-second delay, but for being on the other side of the world, I figure that's not too bad. What you see in the upper right is debug output, just so I can see what the code thinks it's doing. And I was able to use that. If it's not doing what I expect, I can look at that code, figure out what the robot thinks it's doing, what sort of sensor inputs it's getting, and I was able to use that to debug. So it's simply navigating around the maze. It's really simple code as far as navigation goes. Right now, I've actually simplified it a little bit more for the demo, where it's simply just following the right-hand wall, and it's navigating the maze, and it'll continue doing that until I tell it to stop. It's very reliable. You might see it get bump into walls, but it always is able to move away from those, and hopefully not get stuck. And in a second here, what I've got going down here is an IRC session with my helper, a friend of mine who's also a networking Linux networking guy. So if I had any problems with my connection with you know, with the video camera, I was going to have him help out. That's why I had him. By the way, my helper there is Paul Moore. Big hand for him. He's the... for those of you who have ever used NetLabel in the Linux kernel, he's the maintainer of that. So when your network doesn't work, you can blame him. So you'll see that it's found the candle, and that's kind of a bad angle, but it's got it's simply using that cooling fan on the front, and it blows the candle out. And you know, once it sees the candle out, there isn't any logic that says, okay, the candle's out, I should go continue looking. It's even simpler than that. The behavior that's trying to put the candle out no longer sees the candle. That code says, okay, I'm no longer active, which allows the lower priority things that navigate around the maze to become active. And so you really minimize the interaction between multiple threads. And it really simplifies things, allows you to test things independently. So now I can open it up to questions if anybody wants to know more.
So you mentioned that one of your intentions was to learn more about kernel hacking. So did you actually end up getting all your kernel changes submitted in the upstream kernel?
About the getting kernel changes in the upstream kernel, most of this is now upstream. Most of the patches I was using were in someone's Git tree that he was still working on them. He was still working on things like the device driver for the Ethernet and a couple other things that's been pushed upstream. The bit as far as getting it running on this particular board where the memory wasn't laid out properly, it was a bit of a hack at that point, and I know I have to admit, once I got it booted, I had to move on to getting the other bits of code working. I know there's something upstream. I don't know if it's that same bit of code, but yeah, you can boot this board with the latest kernel should boot just fine with the upstream kernel now. Any other questions? Or do you just want to see the robot blow it out more?
Can you talk more a bit about the I2C problems that you had, and how have you actually physically wired that to the ARM board?
I missed the second part of that.
And the actual physical hardware, wiring it to the ARM board.
Okay, about the I2C protocol. It sometimes runs into this situation. Usually I manually aim the sensors a little bit, and Paul's not as familiar with it, so he doesn't know how to aim them. They get bumped every time you move the robot, so before I run it, I usually have to aim it. So technically, it's not supposed to push the candle around, but the way the competition works, as long as you put the candle out, you get the score for that. You just get a little bit of a penalty if you move it around. On the I2C protocol, the way it gets wired in is you use any two general-purpose I/O pins, and then you... they need to be tied high, so they're normally at a 5-volt level, and then each device can pull it low. The ARM board I use doesn't have the hardware to... Normally, this would all be done by a physical hardware device where it doesn't need to be controlled in software, so I just simply had to wire these two general-purpose I/O pins on the ARM. I don't know if you want any more detail, or I'm not sure if that really answers the question. Feel free to any of you to find me afterwards. I spent so much time working on it that I love talking about it, so I love answering questions, so feel free to come ask me. Another thing I'd like to actually demonstrate here, while we have a moment, is how easy it is to change code on this. So what I can do here, and you can see the delay, there it finally stopped. On this other system, I have a window open to my desktop system, which has the cross-compiler, which I can develop code for. I can make code changes and copy it to the robot, which I need to set the mic down for. Okay, what you can see there is you'll notice it was following the right wall as it was navigating around. And in the actual competition, I'd have it try to be intelligent about when it switched left and right wall. So, just to show you how simple it is to reprogram, I make that change. I just have to type make to recompile it. uses the cross compiler. I'm compiling this on an x86 system, but it needs to be compiled to run on an ARM system. And now I just need to copy it over to the robot, and we can run the new program. So just like you would if you're copying files around on a desktop system using SCP, copies the file over. And now that that's there, we can restart the program, and it should follow the left wall instead of the right wall. So we can really see that we really have made our code change. And it turned around, and now it's following the left, the wall on the left side instead of the right side. So that's just a quick example of how easy it is to make code changes. If I was doing this with a more traditional embedded device, I certainly couldn't do it from Australia, because I'd have to go plug into the robot, hit some reset buttons to download the code. But this allows me to do some very convenient code changes. So, yeah, question here? He was asking about handling the ramp where it goes up to the second story. It's not very, very steep, and luckily it does have enough. That was one of the things I made sure I tested fairly early to make sure I had enough power on the motors to get up the ramp. One interesting thing I did, you can see it putting the candle out, so everybody can ooh and ah over that. One thing I did do that I didn't mention here is I wanted to be able to detect when I was upstairs or downstairs, and as it goes up the ramp, I'm measuring the speed of the wheels, and it's hard for the robot to tell the difference between is it stuck and are the wheels just slipping? Is that why the wheels have slowed down, or is it are the wheels going slower because it's going up the ramp? And that was just a dumb bit of code where if it thinks it's stuck, it shuts the power off to the motors, and if it rolls backwards, it says I'm on the ramp. And it was really simple, but it worked pretty well. Originally, I planned on having an accelerometer on it. Where it can actually measure the tilt of the robot and use that, but I never got that that bit of hardware actually incorporated into it. I had a lot of ideas like that unfortunately I ran out of time. As I mentioned, getting the simple stuff working can take quite a while. Another question here?
Just going to mention, if you want a cheap accelerometer, the Wii Nunchuck, if you disassemble it, it has an accelerometer that speaks SPI, and it's like $25.
I've seen some that do SPI. I've seen others that do I2C, so I could hook it into the same bus. The ones I actually have are just an analog signal, so I could run into one of my existing A to D converters. It's simply one more bit of hardware I didn't have time to put in.
Hi. I was interested with the sensors. You said you used a sonar. I was wondering what sort of sonar you used and what sort of information it gave the robot, what sort of form?
The sonar sensors are it's simply a simple transmitter and receiver. It's a prepackaged unit that's sold by a company that sells hobbyist robot stuff. And actually, online, they weren't posted yet, but my slides from the talk should be online on the conference website, and the last couple of slides do have some links to hardware suppliers if anyone's interested in trying to do something themselves. But the way these particular ones work is they're on the I2C bus, so it's all the timing's taken care of by the unit itself. You send a command to that particular address on the I2C bus that tells it to ping, and then a little bit later you ask it and it'll give you the number of microseconds that it took to receive that ping back. So the ARM doesn't need to take care of the actual timing of it. It doesn't need to trigger an interrupt. It's that simple little device able to do very accurate timing. This way I can tell all of them to ping and then later come back on the next time through the loop and ask for how long those took. In the back there, we've got the question.
Hi. I was just wondering about the sensor boards in there powered by the Mega 32s. Are you able to remotely update the code on those as well, or does that require manual intervention?
I missed that. What was that?
With the sensor boards, powered by the Mega32s. Are you able to update the code on those remotely as well?
Yeah, not as easily as reprogramming the robot, the Linux controller itself. But they're really pretty simple to plug into. But it's more the traditional embedded programming I was talking about before. It's pretty simple because you can make your own cable that connects to a parallel port. Of course, most computers don't have parallel ports, so I actually had to buy a parallel port for my computer. It's just a simple four-line connection. It uses four pins, and it's an open-source program that can copy the new code to the AVRs. In the past, I'd used PIC microcontrollers, and I don't know if anybody's familiar with those. The AVRs are much easier to use for an amateur. And you can write regular C code using GCC and its full open source tool chain. All right. Well, thank you very much. I think that's all the questions, sounds like.